Hello, and thanks for listening to the Ordinary Philosophy podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, to see the photo series that accompanies this account, and to discover the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and so depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the subscribe, submit, and support page and donate today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 50, Frederick Douglass, Lynn, Massachusetts Sites. Seventh day, Saturday, March 26th. I drive from Boston to Lynn, Massachusetts, only about 25 minutes north by car. Not long after Frederick Douglass began his public speaking career, he and his family moved here to Lynn from New Bedford. They lived here from the fall of 1841 through about November 1847. Well, actually, for much of that time, it was mostly Anna and the kids who lived here. First, Douglass was often on tour as a speaker, which took him away from home for long stretches. Secondly, he was away on a tour of the British Isles from 1845 until 1847. Which is why many sources say Douglass himself only lived here until 1845. He returned only briefly to Lynn before moving himself and his family to Rochester near the end of 1847. His, quote, industrious and neat companion, as he described Anna, took care of the household while he was away, and often took in piecework from Lynn's thriving shoemaking industry to make sure the kids were always cared for and the bills paid on time. Douglass wrote his narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, here in Lynn, and it was published by the Boston Anti-Slavery Society on May 28, 1845. It sold well, and he became more than a bit nervous. He enjoyed freedom so much, of course, and now that he had a family, he had even more to lose if he was to be captured and returned to slavery. After all, as discussed, he had said some not too nice things in his narrative about his former master, who legally still was, and who knows how badly Thomas Auld would have wanted to have him back in bondage. So, to avoid capture now that he publicly named his master and his whereabouts were now more widely known, he sailed to England on August 6th, 1845, and embarked on an 18-month lecture tour of England and Ireland. Eventually, his abolitionist friends raised enough money to buy his freedom, or, as he conceived of it, to pay his ransom, and he was able to return home, arriving back in Lynn on April 20th, 1847. Though he was away so much, Lynn still played a significant role in his life. Lynn proves to be a Douglass treasure trove for me, primarily thanks to the Lynn Museum and Historical Society. Thank you so much to Nicole Brault, I hope I'm saying your name right, Nicole, for arranging my visit, and Britt Bowen, who gave me access to historical artifacts for study, the kind ladies who greeted me and showed me around, and everyone else there who made this place a beautiful place to visit and a great resource. In fact, my visit to the museum was so full of wonderful discoveries that it needs its own separate piece, which will follow shortly. After I tear myself away from the museum and go eat a bit of lunch, I head for my first destination. On the way, my attention is caught by this vibrant mural on the side of the Lynn Arts Building at 25 Exchange Street, where a portrait of Douglass presides over images of Lynn's historical figures and creative and curious children and other people of today. I'm heading for the site of the old Central Square train station. Downtown Lynn is not easy for a first-time visitor to navigate. No two streets seem to join at right angles. It takes me a few go-rounds to orient myself generally, yet I still find myself often a little lost among the tangled streets. A man who tends a little restaurant called Capital Diner, which looks just like an old red train car, helps confirm that the place where the elevated tracks run above where Central Square meets Union and Exchange Streets is just about directly over the site of the early 1800s train depots. There were a series of them, across the street from the mural on the side of the Arts Building. According to Wikipedia, quote, "The first depot at the Central Square location, built in 1838, was a small wooden building. It was replaced in 1848 with a brick building with a two-track train shed." So it was in that smaller wooden incarnation that an incident occurred at this stop of a train between Boston and Portland, Maine, where Douglas resisted being forced into a Jim Crow segregated car on September 28, 1841, while he was riding the train with his friend James N. Buffum, who would become mayor of Lynn, and had inspired him to move to Lynn in the first place. He simply refused to leave his seat, and when employees of the railroad company tried to remove him by force, he hung onto the seat until they were ripped and torn out of place. As Edward Covey, the slave breaker, had discovered some years earlier, Douglas was physically strong and no pushover. Over time, he ended up doing this sort of protest often, to raise awareness. His letter about this experience was published in a newspaper, and local indignation and protests over this incident helped lead to the eventual end of segregated train cars in New England. It's hard to imagine, to a modern reader in such an interconnected world, that there would be such a patchwork of racial sentiment in a geographic area that it took me only a few hours to cross by car. In Maryland, he was a slave. In New York City, he was free but in danger of being beaten or captured. In Boston, his narrative was published in the same city where he was denied entry to the menagerie on Boston Common because, quote, as he said, "We don't allow niggers in here." I hate saying that word. Anyway, in Lynn, the trains were desegregated over rude treatment of a black customer. Amazing. In Central Square, I'm close to the site of Sagamore Hall, where John Brown, fiery abolitionist and friend and hero of Douglas, used to speak. Sagamore Hall was close and to the west of the depot, between Union and Mount Vernon Streets, north of Exchange, also where that part of the elevated track structure now stands. If you look closely at the photo of the mural we looked at earlier, you'll see the image of a burning building just under Douglas's portrait. That's Sagamore Hall burning down on November 25, 1843. I'll tell more about how John Brown figured in Douglas's life, which was very significantly, before long. You've likely heard of him. He led the unsuccessful raid on Harper's Ferry from October 16th to 18th, 1859, in hopes of jump-starting a slave insurrection by providing them with a source of arms, and was hanged as a traitor for his trouble. But when Douglas lived here throughout the early to mid-1840s, he had not yet met John Brown, though they were here in Lynn contemporaneously. As Douglas tells it in his Life and Times, a later autobiography, they would meet later, when Douglas lived in Rochester, New York. Then I head to the corner of Broad and Market Streets near the site of Harrison Court, where the first of the three Douglas family homes in Lynn used to stand. I'm visiting the three Douglas home sites in chronological order. There's not much of historical interest here now. Commercial buildings, broad highways, the big train stations, and the iron skeleton of some new structure under construction. There are some great photos of the area near Market and Broad Streets at the Longyear Museum website's Mary Baker Eddy photo gallery page. She lived a few blocks east of here at 8 Broad Street, and that home still stands. And if you look at maps of Lynn from 1852 and from 1872, which I linked to in the website, you can see where Harrison Court used to stand. I include links to both maps because, though the older one is closer to the Douglas's time here and more accurate for our purposes, the later map shows more detail when you zoom in. If you look at the center bottom of the map, just above the waterline and a little to the right where two large streets come together in the point of a wedge. You click on that part to zoom in, and Harrison Court stood between the point of the wedge and the main street running north and south to the left, which is Market, below Harrison Street. Though none of the buildings from that time remain today, in any case, the modern openness of this place with the grassy Carroll Parkway, the bright blue sky, and the sea breeze is nice. Then I take a brisk walk to my next destination, briefly east on Broad Street, then left, which is north, up Union Street, then left again on Baldwin to the corner of Baldwin and High Streets. This is near the place where the Douglas family's second home in Lynn used to stand. There are no street signs at all on this corner. Missing street signs here and there is another reason I've been having just a little trouble finding some places, so hooray for GPS. There's now a tire and car care business, a white house with solar panels on its sharply pointed roof, and a three-floor red brick building with arched windows. High and Baldwin Streets meet here to make a V. The house, owned by Abel Houghton Jr., and where the Douglases lived only briefly, stood somewhere near this corner. If you look at the 1872 map again, linked to on the website, you could see the area where this house used to stand by following Union Street from the point of that wedge where it meets Market to the northwest, then see where Pearl Street, which is now Baldwin, meets it, running north and south with a crooked angle like a bent arm, with High Street meeting it at that angle at the inner elbow. Referring again to that 1852 map, I don't find the name of Abel Houghton Jr. or his Horticultural Society listed there, but it's hard to read some of the names, or it may have changed hands in the approximate decade between the time the Douglases lived here and the time that map was drafted. Then I head southeast on Silsby Street, which turns into Newhall Street. I follow Newhall south to a stretch between Sagamore and Setchum Streets, where the third Douglas family home in Lynn once stood. This is where he wrote his narrative, where his family lived while he was in the British Isles from August 1845 to April 1847, and where he returned home after arriving in Boston on April 20th. When she saw me looking around and taking photos, a lady named Crystal, who, as she said, was born and raised here, helpfully confirmed that the parking lot on Newhall between Santo Domingo Liquor Store and Setchum Streets, where Amity Street ends, is the site where the Douglas home once stood. As the old maps say, it's also where, or about where, someone named Chase lived. As a placard describing the sites of the old Douglas's home in the Lynn Museum describes, the house was moved once to Sagamore Street nearby, but was eventually demolished. Then I return to the car and drive just over 5 minutes away to Lynn Commons, which runs between the one-way streets of North and South Common, and park along South Common near Shepherd Street. I walk east on South Common a little ways and then turn left on the path that cuts across the park and ends at Harwood Street on the other side. But halfway across the common, before I would reach Harwood Street, to my left, there's a white raised gazebo surrounded by benches to create a little amphitheater, and on my right stands a stone and brass monument to Frederick Douglass. The raised gazebo is a Frederick Douglass bandstand, built in 1887 near the site where Douglass used to deliver many anti-slavery speeches here from an earlier structure, which was perhaps on or near the spot where the memorial is now. So ends my eventful day in Lynn, Massachusetts, but really, there's much more to come. Remember, I haven't yet finished telling the whole story of today's journey, which includes a couple fascinating hours in the Lynn Museum and Historical Society this morning. The account is soon to follow. And I'm only halfway through my trip. There's still 7 days to go. As always, thanks for listening, and any support you can lend Ordinary Philosophy, be it financial, sharing with your friends, liking on Facebook, on Tumblr, rating this podcast on iTunes, all of those are absolutely essential for the success of this endeavor. I cannot do it without you. Thanks, as always, for listening.